want to break into the system.
Someone without access to the temple.
I have been doing a little packing in here, as a matter of fact.
Computers and the programs will start thinking, and the people will stop.
I still don't understand why you want to break the system.
Because, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in for it, I could be destructive.
Everyone, welcome to the October 31st edition of the In the Now Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with Sidekick.
VR.
VR in the house. Okay, all right. Well, we've had quite a festive last few minutes getting the show ready.
Yeah, all the ghouls running around. It's pretty spooky in here.
Yeah. Well, we're very sorry that we haven't put up the October 17th show, if you guys already noticed, but things happen in life, and we're going to redo that show with those topics and put that up at a later time.
We'll get it up there.
Yep. All right, and of course you'll see us again after this show in 2 weeks. We're here to stay, and all right, let's move on. How are you doing, VR?
What was that, huh?
I said, how you doing?
Oh, I'm good. All yeah. Right. I don't think they could remove us even with the court order.
Yeah. And, wow. Yeah, you know, it's kind of feeling good to be back on the mic. I've been away from it for a while.
Yeah. It's got this weird... It feels a little foreign. I don't quite have it back to...
But yet, like, fresh.
Yeah, it's this old familiarity. It's like one of those exes from years back that you kind of know what's going on, but not really.
Or you found that old blanket?
I don't know about that.
That blanket you had for years? Okay, that story doesn't fit me either.
Yeah, whatever.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, is that what that thing over there is?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was just, you know, like a rag.
All right, well, moving on to... our stories here. You know, there's a new protocol out that was created. And
yay, more processes. Woohoo!
Yes. It's all about inventing processes that are better than yours. Or better than someone's.
Yeah, there you go.
But yeah, it's...
Because my protocol is the ultimate protocol.
It's called Protozoid. But, all right, well, here it goes. It attempts to... beat TCP at speed, throughput, and just overall getting rid of the TCP vulnerabilities or lack thereof functionality.
Good, good.
All right, rateless internet is an internet transport protocol implemented over UDP, meant as a better replacement of TCP. TCP's legacy design carries a number of inefficiencies, the most prominent of which is its inability to utilize most modern links bandwidth.
Ooh.
This problem stems from the fact that TCP calculates the congestion of the channel based on its round-trip time. The round-trip time, however, reflects not only the congestion level, but also the physical length of the connection.
Yep.
This is precisely why TCP is inherently unable to reach optimal speeds on long, high-bandwidth connections.
Huh.
Secondly, just as impairing, a property of TCP is its inability to tolerate even small amounts, 1 to 3% of packet loss. This additionally forces TCP to work at safe and relatively low transmission speeds with under 1% loss rates. Nevertheless, our extended real-life measurements show that highest throughput is generally achieved at speeds with anywhere between 3 to 5% loss. And basically, how it works here is... it can circumvent both of the four mentioned deficiencies of TCP while still remaining TCP-friendly. By using encoded rather than plain transmissions, we are able to send at speeds with packet loss with any packet loss level, Rateless coding is used in conjunction with our universal congestion control algorithm, which allows rateless internet to remain friendly to TCP and other congestion-aware protocols.
Hmm.
Universal congestion control is an algorithm for transmission speed control. It is based on a simple and clean idea. The speed is varied in a wave-like fashion. The top of the wave achieves near optimal throughput, while the bottom is low enough to let coexisting protocols like TCP smoothly receive a fair share of bandwidth. The time lengths of the peaks and troughs can be adjusted paramedically.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was at first. To achieve customized levels of fairness between rateless internet and TCP, rateless internet transport is now available through our rateless socket product or in the form of a C, C++ socket library. Rateless internet is ideal for internet-based applications running on network edges that require high bandwidth in a heterogeneous environment. It was specifically built with peer-to-peer and live multimedia content delivery applications in mind. What UDP is there's no no error connection or no connection tracking, no three-way handshake. Just kind of sends a packet out, and if it gets out there, then, hey, it does. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And it seems like what this does is it throttles the packets in a way to where, I don't know, it gets to the other end. And I read something else, too, in another page of this website that it uses, and I don't know if it was that one algorithm right there that was talking about the congestion control algorithm. No, it wasn't. It was something else that calculated, it was like a sequencing type of thing, and then when it got to the other end, it made sure that it got there, but it never needed to retransmit packets.
Oh, see, yeah, because it actually, like, codes all the packets and just, you know, like, 1 through 64, and like the first packet is 1 through 64, this is how many the range is.
Well, yeah, TCP is like that. And if it notices one is missing, then it'll say, hey, send it again. And this one, I don't know what happens if a link just disappears. That's the one thing I'm not quite sure about this protocol.
Yeah, that you could lose all kinds of information that you want.
Yeah,
And you'll never know that you lost it.
Yeah, I think it's meant for things that are like streaming, that if it goes down, it goes down.
Yeah.
But,
nothing important.
Yeah. Something to check out, though. Just Google up rateless internet. Don't have the link right here in front of me. All right. Well, it's always hard to get a new protocol to be accepted. They are, drafting up an RFC for it, though. Okay.
RFC?
Request for comment. It's kind of like how everything's designed out there on the internet, and a lot of standards and 802.11 whatever's got a RFC number that says, like, this is how it works.
All right.
It's it's like a universal body of like, this is what this is. This is how it works, and these are the parameters and guidelines that it has to operate by to be this to be compliant when different vendors are creating the same thing.
For compatibility issues.
Yes. Okay. All right, well, moving right along, on to a story about fishing.
Fly fishing?
No, P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G.
What's fishing?
Well, fishing is when you pose as a... It's kind of like social engineering. It basically is a lot of people out there lately have been doing... fishing, which is posing as a company, like sending you an email saying, hey, I'm from Bank of America, but it's really not.
Yeah, I've gotten a few of those lately, but they're not from Bank of America.
Yeah, and they try to get you to submit information or passwords or, you know, personal information, passwords or other related things to get that out of you. That's very, very devious, and it's actually... they have success rates of as high as 50% on when those attacks happen.
Oh, my.
Yes. The number of people who succumb to identity thieves' phishing emails could go way up if immediate action isn't taken to preempt the next generation of attacks, according to Marcus Jacobson, an Indian University School of Informatics researcher. A report by cybersecurity expert Jacobson describing worst-case phishing scenarios was recently cited by Howard Schmidt, Chief Information Security Officer for eBay Incorporated. During his testimony before a U.S. Congressional Subcommittee on government reform. The report has also been presented to members of the U.S. Government Accountability Office and the Cybersecurity Industry Alliance based in Washington, D.C. I came up with the worst kind of attacks I could think of and then worked out how to defend against them, said Jacobson, who is associate director of the IU Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research. Phishers haven't invented these attacks yet, but phishing attacks that are happening now are getting more and more sophisticated. So basically, he gauged ahead and came up with some of these new attacks that could happen and is trying to find ways to defend against them before they come out. Davidson said preliminary data suggests that savvier, context-aware phishing attacks could have success rates as high as 50%. Context-aware attacks, as Jacobson envisions them, would take advantage of the user's unique circumstances or personal relationships. One kind of context-aware attack, Jacobson describes, tricks eBay bidders into giving out identification or out identifying information about by leading bidders to believe they've won an auction. He also explains how eBay sellers can be victimized by content-aware attacks in which false payments lure sellers to give out their passwords. In another kind of context-aware attack, a potential victim might receive a message from a known person, for example, a friend or loved one, asking him or her to go on a website to update banking information, but how would a phisher know who was related to who and by whom, or to whom and how? There are personal and business networking websites out there, such as Orkut.com, where users' relationships are easily seen. Jacobson said a phisher can find out whether a person is in your personal network list as a wife, husband, sister, or a business associate, and take advantage of that. In a third kind of context-aware attack, the phisher creates a believable but fictitious problem with a user's online account and then asks for a user's personal information to fix it. By analogy, current email attacks are like phone repair personnel showing up out of the blue, claiming the potential victim's phone lines aren't working, when the victim can easily tell they are. But now imagine the attacker actually cut your telephone lines, Jacobson explained, and wait for you to notice. Then I show up, claiming to be there to fix the problem. I appear legitimate and everything seems consistent, so you invite me into your property. Whenever you get emails requesting personal information, no matter what the circumstances, be skeptical, even if what you're seeing appears legitimate. Jacobson is part of a UI that develops technological countermeasures to phishing and other types of internet fraud. Members of the group are currently working on authentication software that would protect users from unknowingly entering PINs, usernames, passwords at legitimate websites. So,
yay.
Yes. That is, so people are actually out there trying to take some initiative to cutting down on the phishing attacks out there that actually can be pretty bad if somebody falls into them.
Yeah, and you can just accidentally do it. And then somebody can steal your entire identity.
Yes. And that's
bad.
Yeah, that's a bunch of crap.
Because it's my identity. Not your identity, mine. See, it's all about my identity.
And would you, like, break out the Kung Fu grip?
No, not part of my identity.
Not part of my identity. All right.
I was not manufactured with Kung Fu grip.
Yeah. But I do have real live-action laser eyeballs.
That is correct, sir.
Which is a lead button, or a button putting LEDs on and off. All right. Well, we've talked about Echelon before, and Echelon is a system that listens to all sorts of data from phone lines and communications and says, is this person saying things that we should be listening to or not? And then starts listening if it thinks you're doing something you shouldn't be.
If it suits its purpose.
Yes. All right. Well, this article here basically describes some of the ins and outs of how this this technology works. And it gets in here pretty deep. But I think the tech people out there will appreciate it. It works like this. The calls are recorded by geostationary spy satellites and listening stations, such as the UK's Menwith Hill, which combines satellite interception calls and trunk landline intercepts and forward them on to centers such as the U.S. Fort Meade, where supercomputers work on the recordings in real time. Texas Memory Systems, and you'll see it referred to in the article as TMS, SAM product, a combined solid-state disk and digital signal processor. Woody Hutzel, as an executive at TMS, said 50% of our revenue this year will come from our DSP systems, more than last year. What they're talking about is some of the hardware that they use in the Echelon system. The systems are a combination of SSD, which is the solid-state disk, with the digital signal processors. ASICs are application-specific integrated circuits, chips dedicated for a specific purpose. TMS has a TM44 DSP chip, which has 8 gigaflops of processing power. That's 8 billion floating point operations per second. The processing use floating point arithmetic operations to supply the accuracy needed for the analysis. A DSP chip turns analog signals from a sensor or a recorder into digital information usable by a computer. Digital cameras will use DSP to turn light signals coming in from the lens into a digital picture element or pixel information. A SAM650 product is called a 192 gigaflops DSP supercomputer by TMS. It's just a 3U high and has 24 DSP chips and is positioned as a back-end number cruncher controller as any standard server. A similar architecture to that used by Cray supercomputers. There are vast streams of information coming from the recorded telephone conversations. The ability to have the DSPs work in parallel speeds of analysis speeds up analysis enormously. Spinning hard drives can't feed the DSPs fast enough, nor are they quick enough for subsequent software analysis of the data. Consequently, TMS uses its solid-state technology to provide a buffer of up to 32 gigabytes that keeps the DSPs operating at full speed. A cluster of 5 SAM650s provides a teraflop of processing power, 1 trillion floating points, floating operations per second. Echelon is a global surveillance network set up in the Cold War days to provide the U.S. government with data intelligence or intelligence data about Russia. One of the main contractors is Raytheon, which actually they're down in Tucson, not too far from here. Lockheed Martin has been involved in writing the software for it. Since then, it has expanded into a general listening facility, an electronic vacuum cleaner sucking up the world's telephone conversations. Information about its existence has been reluctantly revealed, corrupted by scandals such as recordings of Princess Diana's telephone calls by the NSA. Recorded signals are fed into the TMS SAM systems, where the DSPs filter out the noise to produce much clearer signals that software can work with or detect individual voices, perform voice recognition, and listen out for keywords such as, for example, Semtex. Decryption of encrypted calls is also a likely activity. So, that's quite impressive to have a system like that out there that is running and listening to all the stuff that goes on the phones. I don't know how much it listens to, and I don't know if you have to get a search warrant to use the Echelon system, or it's just running on major communication hubs and...
Oh, it's probably just running on everything. Yeah. That'd be the best way to search.
Yeah, which is really interesting because you'd wonder that that's kind of a total violation of your privacy rights.
That it is, except if they're a public utility.
What do you mean by that? Like,
it's kind of like, well, you can monitor people in public. You know, you can take somebody's picture in public. You don't have to ask. But now if you do it in private, now you got to ask.
Really? So they would look at a public utility in that manner?
I don't know. You probably could. Get a couple of very liberal Supreme Court judges. You could do that. Except it's a private line. So it's where they monitor. So they monitor on, you know, like on your actual line, or when it goes to like voice over IP. Now it's on the internet. Really?
It is an interesting way to look at it. I'm not sure if that's if that falls into that category, but it probably possibly could be argued that way.
Yeah. So it does, you know, it brings some interesting issues to the table of what, you know, it really comes down to is where you draw your lines, really, because nothing's right or wrong. It's just a big gray. It's where you draw your lines of what you believe, where you stand, or the circle around you. You know, what are your shades of gray of the world?
Yeah, and those lines are constantly being questioned daily.
Yeah.
Constantly being questioned on the show. it's a never-ending thing. But to think that something out there like that is out there listening and they have the capability to do so is...
It's a little scary because it, you know, like, it's very Big Brother-esque.
Yeah, extremely. And, you know, you kind of wonder, like, how much Big Brother is actually exists out there. And I think a lot of people have asked that question, and books have been written about that. And
but yeah, you have 1984.
It's also kind of interesting to think of what happens when you get captured by Big Brother. Do they, like, invite you to the Big Brother clan?
No, he gives you a wedgie and let you go on your way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting how people travel in this world by their interest in the things that happen to them and the things that they create. And it's almost... I don't know if getting, listened to by Echelon's a bad thing or a good thing. Depends on
what
they're listening for. And
well, it also depends, is what they're listening to. If they catch somebody because they can listen, and that was the only way they caught them, that saved your life, is that a good thing? But now, how many innocent people is the Echelon system going to hurt? Because, yeah, it can be a violation of your privacy. Not a right.
I kind of wonder if they actually just collect the information and they're never really able to use any of the recordings because they can't legally justify the recordings in the first place. It's like denying that Area 51 actually exists, you know, so they don't have to disclose certain information about it because it doesn't exist on paper.
Right.
You know, so like... Maybe it's just an intelligence gathering thing where they talk about, well, there's chatter out there. You know, is the Echelon system picking up chatter? You know, is it just like trying to tap into the communications world and just see what's floating out there? And then that information is used and, you know.
Well, yeah, if it's just an impure intelligence gathering way that it's just trying to reconstruct reality, you know, in order to... I don't know, protect us, keep us secure, all that. Might not be bad. But why just do it in this country? That's a rather incomplete picture.
Yeah, supposedly it's actually used, like Australia uses something like that. The European Union, supposedly, and us.
Huh.
All are doing that. They say Australia, from what we've talked about before, actually has quite an extensive system for monitoring its communications and people.
Yeah, they're an interesting, interesting country.
Yeah.
They do some things very well. Like, I really enjoy how they have to vote. It's not a choice.
What do you mean they have to vote?
Like, if you're a citizen, you're required to vote.
What happens if you don't? You're fine?
I don't know. That's just what I've been told by an Australian.
Hmm.
So... I thought that was an iffy little factoid.
And then he follows it up by, you have to buy me a beer.
No.
And you're like, what?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, moving along to other supercomputing power out there. There is a new big block in the world of supercomputers at the very top now. Which NEC has created. Which actually, NEC made the Turbo Graphics. Pretty cool stuff. Yeah, it's a NEC's SX8 is a vector supercomputer that has a peak processing performance of 65 teraflops, which is 65 trillion calculations every second.
Wow. It's not just 1 trillion. It's how many trillion?
65.
65 trillion. That's mind-blowing.
That's insane. The Earth computer, I think, was 35 trillion. Was the other one? Yeah, this is 65. This is let's see, that's almost twice as fast as the 3601 teraflops achieved in September by a prototype version of IBM's BlueJean computer, supercomputer. That performance, measured using the standard Linpack benchmark, made BlueJean the fastest supercomputer in the world, ahead of NEC built Earth simulator computer, which had managed to have sustained a performance of 35.86. teraflops in the same benchmark. However, the SSA hasn't edged out of Blue Jean yet. Its performance figure is only an estimate. Oh, it's an estimate. One NEC thinks it can achieve. There are three versions of the SX8 available. Wow, like they're just giving these out like candy. the two single node and one multi node, and the 65 teraflops performance refers to the top of the line multi node machine. This has the maximum of 512 nodes with 8 processors to make a total of 4,096 processors. The maximum memory is 64 terabytes. And the maximum data transfer is 262 terabytes per second. The two single node versions of the SX8 with between 4 and 8 processors, and the SX8B with between 1 and 4 processors. Wow. You know, I just don't understand. You know, they say they have stuff that they can run calculations through to, like, bombard with this type of computing power, but I don't have a clue to what they could be using those kinds of things for. They're like, we can figure out nuclear something-somethings, you know what I'm like?
Yeah, well, because what the good thing about that is that you can actually do simulations of nuclear testing, and you don't actually have to, you know, launch the nuke.
Yes. You know, but I don't understand, like, Do you get your results back in the 1 second? Or does, like, you know...
Well, it depends on how big the calculation is. You know, because if it's doing weather forecasting, well, it can still take quite some time.
But wouldn't you think... What I'm thinking about is, like, when you process that much, right, you would have to have a whole bunch of variables, and collecting that, like, physically or whatever way of collecting those variables is insane. I don't know where they're collecting those variables, even input, to even bounce off those numbers to get those types of, you know, trillions of calculations.
Or it could be, you know, like, you know, some irrational number calculations.
They're like, here. And, you know, I think they'd have to make a very complex environment to be able to sustain the level of, you know, computation that it's existing in, you know, that's just insane. Like, there are simulator. I mean, I should.
Or it's just a little, like, one line script that says count.
Count, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. And,
it comes back in, you know, like, you know, however long in a second, and it comes back 65 trillion.
Or are they just playing, like, Doom 3 on there? Like, I really would like to just sit down and, like, say, can you, like, show me what you're doing here and explain this to me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. All right. Well, this is something that Steve Ballmer says. He says that Steve Ballmer's biggest headaches is not Linux or security breaches. It's piracy. And,
Armity.
Yeah. You know, honestly, piracy doesn't hurt the consumer. So, I don't know, the security kind of hurts the consumer quite a bit. Shouldn't you be worrying about what the consumer's got to worry about the most?
Yeah.
You know, I understand that for his company, he's got to worry about piracy. But, you know, what's funny about this article is what it basically says is, we need a $100 PC. Because he says that the reason that people aren't paying for software so much is because they got to pay for hardware as well.
Well, yeah, that's one excuse.
Yeah, like, screw but the hardware other companies and... make it okay for the software.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Or it's because they'd rather spend their money on something else.
Yeah, well, obviously Microsoft's a software company, not a hardware company.
That's right.
But they do make mice, but that's about it. The biggest problem we have right now is that people who should be paying for software aren't. One way to stem piracy is to offer consumers in emerging countries low-cost PC. How about a low-cost operating system? There has to, like, a free one, like Linux.
Yeah.
There has to be a $100 computer to go down market in some of these countries. People in four countries have a low cost computation option. Have one low cost computation option. They have a lease PC concept, the internet safe pay by the drink computer use that has a very important place in the market. Microsoft has five times as many Hotmail users in India and China, then there are PCs because of this. Ballmer said piracy of Microsoft Windows and Office software in emerging markets has become a major concern for the software giant, especially among business users who can afford to pay the software. PCs are not selling to the lower end of population in China and India. People buying machines, they are relatively fluent, so should the prices be lower? Not really. Until government and situational factors reduce piracy, those people don't pay. Well, you know, I don't know. I think people look at software as a tool for society. And most people are, you know, if they can, they're willing to help and better improve the software, just like they do in Linux. And if they can't code, they give bug reports and suggest options and ideas. Or
well, it's more like language.
Yeah.
You know, words, air and breath and all that.
Yeah, and it's an evolving thing. Now, obviously, the market is fueled by capitalism to keep it going, but well, we've also shown that there's other methods out there to bring tools to make the world a more useful place or to be more efficient.
Yes. Cut down on process.
Yeah. Cut down on process or allow new processes to take place.
Which does more for, you know, does actually less to do more. Less process.
Yeah. You know, and you got to think that, you know, with how much dough Microsoft has before, you know, I mean, they do sell a lot of different products, so there's a lot of different ways of making profit. But the amount of profit made at times, doesn't mean all times, but at times is quite a bit, I believe. And that's why people are just pirating it, because, hey, it's a lot of darn money. Especially if you translate the cost of what is U.S. dollars over to another country.
Yeah. That would be a amazing amount of money in some countries.
Yes. Now, here's an interesting article about electronic voting machines, and it's coming from an angle that we haven't quite explored here on the show. Well, kind of explored, but this is the total article is focused on this. Voters worry that an electronic voting machine might accidentally eat their vote on November 2nd would be better off pointing their blame at the clueless poll workers than a shiny new touchscreen machines.
That's right.
According to information released by the Information Technology Association of America. Just a quick thought here. What the heck is the Information Technology Association of America? Those damn associations trying to drag you into their little crew, their little group, build that little name for whatever strange purpose.
That's right. To make more money.
Make more money. The technology industry group, which is a staunch supporter of electronic voting technology, made the argument in a document that was distributed to help journalists put election equipment related snafus in content. While electronic voting machines aren't blameless, but are just one of an important an election day puzzle that includes the local election officials and volunteers, some of whom can't even have scant or uneven training, the ITA said. The document outlines a number of woeful election day scenarios, from missing voter registration to incorrect ballot information and non-functioning electronic voting machines. In each case, the ITA offers possible explanations for the mishap, often with the effect of exonerating the voting machine. For example, a human error may explain voting machines that will not turn on or not operate, the group wrote. Poll workers may not have plugged in the machines or forgotten the password required to start the machines, resulting in lengthy delays as this information is retrieved from other sources. The idea behind the media primer is to get journalists to get better understanding of how electronic voting technology works and not always assume that the problems are voting due to failures of electronic voting technology. Okay. Well, that points out a problem, you know. It's just that they just don't know what they're doing, and if you've ever seen some big exec try to pull off his PowerPoint presentation and I think bombs or a screensaver comes up during the middle of it, and they just, you know, don't know what they're doing, and they thought that, you know, they're going to lose $50 million on this deal if they can't get this darn laptop to work.
Yeah.
You know, here in Arizona, okay, the voting was the same as it was, it's going to be the same as it was last year, which was all it is you just have a little arrow that's kind of broken in the center, And then when you want to select something, you just fill in that that line in the middle. And now the arrow is a complete arrow.
That's right.
Points to your option. You go over and you walk it over this little thing. You slide it in there, right? And it's there. And then they take it and they count it. I mean, it's just so damn simple. You don't have to worry about passwords, power buttons.
I know, and there's a double verification. You know, you have electronic copy, you have a paper copy. You know, there's...
And even if the power goes out, you can still vote.
That's right.
You know? Like, what happens if the world switches over to electronic voting and all of a sudden, I don't know, someone shuts the power out in some area, something like that. Which did happen, actually. There was the power went out in this one area. And actually, they had a... somebody had mentioned something about a voting machine that there's two locks on it. One of the locks was to like the power button, and another one was to like to where the computer was. And the lock to the power button was like unlocked. It's just a bunch of crap, you know. Just fill in your arrow, turn the damn thing in, go let it get counted, send the number off, you're done. I mean, it just doesn't get any simpler than that.
Yeah.
The only thing I could see is it makes it quicker, and that's it. And that's all I can see. And, you know, they scan those things just like they'd scan your, your like a Scantron test. You know,
yeah, Scantron test.
And there you go. You know, and those things are calibrated. And, they scan it. And I don't hear anybody ever complain about those things. They never say, oh, that thing scanned them all wrong. I haven't even heard anything in the news about that whatsoever.
Yeah, so, because they're fairly accurate. Actually, they'd be really accurate.
Yeah, it's very simple and simplicity, you know? That's why I'm not the most, like, person. I like finding out about new technologies, but I'm not a person that usually jumps to the new technology, you know? Like, I still don't have a PDA. Like, I don't really care about a PDA, you know? I know that it is very functional for some people, just not me. But a lot of people have those PDAs, and I see them not do anything with it. All it is a scheduler and holds their contacts.
It's a personal vanity device.
Yeah, a PVA. Or PVD. But I have my cell phone actually it does that. So not, I do have that functionality. But at least it's integrated into something useful that I use more often, which is like the phone. They have those big, huge PDA phones, but those are quite big. Okay, well, I'm getting off on a tangent here, but basically it's all about simplicity. And and yet again, we pointed out there that sometimes it's just problems just getting the darn things to function or little stupid things.
Don't get it all fancy. Just keep it simple and consistent.
Yeah. So, all right, VR. Now, this is the article I was telling you about. So you get to have a listen here and see what you think.
All right.
Okay. A University of Florida scientist has grown a living brain that can fly a simulated plane, giving scientists a novel way to observe how brain cells function as a network. The brain, consisting of 25,000 living neurons or nerve cells taken from a rat's brain and cultured inside a glass dish, gives scientists a unique real-time window into the brain at a cellular level. By watching their brain cells interact, scientists hope to understand what causes the neural disorders, such as epilepsy, and to determine non-invasive ways to intervene. It's living computers. They may someday be used to fly small unmanned airplanes or handle tasks that are dangerous for humans, such as search and rescue missions or bomb damage assessments. Interested in studying how brains compute, Thomas DeMarsh of the UF Professor of Biomedical Engineering, who designed the study, if you think about your brain, your learning and the memory process, I can ask you questions about when you were 5 years old, and you can retrieve information. That's a tremendous capacity for memory. In fact, you perform fairly simple tasks that you would think a computer would easily be able to accomplish, but in fact, it can't. While computers are very fast at processing some kinds of information, they can't approach the flexibility of the human brain, DeMarsh said. In particular, brains can easily make certain kinds of computations, such as recognizing an unfamiliar piece of furniture as a table or a lamp, that are very difficult to program into today's computers.
Yeah, because it puts this whole factor of little chaos and infidelity into it.
Yes. If we extract the rules on how these neural networks are doing computations like pattern recognition, we can apply that to create overall computing systems, he said.
Yeah, but then you have to have, some really, at least decent artificial intelligence.
Yes. Which is like source code writing, source code.
Yeah, which is kind of like the I am as I am.
DeMar's experimental brain interacts with an F-22 fighter jet flight simulator, though, through a specially designed plate called a multi-electroarray in a common desktop computer. It's essentially a dish with 60 electrodes arranged in a grid at the bottom, DeMar said. Over that, we put the living cordial neurons from rats, which rapidly begin to reconnect themselves, forming a living neural network of brain. The brain in the simulator establish a two-way connection, similar to how neurons receive and interpret signals back from each other's bodies, or back from each other to control our bodies. By observing how the nerve cells interact with the simulator, scientists can decode how a neural network establishes connections and begins to commute, DeMarsh said. With DeMarsh first puts the neurons in the dish, they look more like little grains of sand sprinkled in water. However, individual neurons soon begin to extend microscopic lines towards each other,
called dendrites,
making connections that represent neural processes. You see or extend a process, pull it back, extend it out, and it may do a couple of things, just sampling who's next to it. Over time, the connectivity starts to establish itself, he said. The brain is getting its network to the point to where it's a live computational device. To control the simulated aircraft, the neurons first receive information from the computer about flight conditions, whether the plane is flying straight or in level, or is tilted to the left or the right. The neurons then analyze the data and respond by sending signals to the plane's controls. Those signals alter the flight path, and new information is sent to the neurons, creating a feedback system. Initially, we hook up this brain to a flight simulator. It doesn't know how to control the aircraft, DeMar said. So you hook it up, and the aircraft simply drifts randomly. And as the data comes in, it slowly modifies the neural network, so over time, the network gradually learns to fly the aircraft. Although the brain currently is able to control the pitch and roll, the simulator aircraft in weather conditions ranging from blue skies to stormy hurricane-force winds, the underlying goal is more fundamental understanding how neurons interact as a network, DeMar said. There's lots more data out there that will tell you the computational that's going on and here isn't based on just one neuron. The computational property is actually an emerging property of hundreds of thousands of neurons cooperating to produce the amazing processing power of the brain. Goes on to a few more things, but it's quite interesting. I don't think it really understands what it's doing as far as flying a plane, but I think what it's really doing is like seeing how it reacts to information being given to it.
Yeah, that it's actually can work on a stimulus reward system. Really interesting.
Yeah, what I'm curious is how it actually sends the information to neurons.
I want to know how they keep them alive, too.
Yeah, I don't know if they keep them in some sort of protein dish or something like that.
Yeah, but it wouldn't take long for it to essentially starve.
That's why you got to feed it Wheaties.
That's right.
Neuron Wheaties. It's good for the neurons. It's good for you. All right. Okay, moving right along. President Bush's website is blocked outside the U.S.
Huh. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I don't really know what that serves. I mean, like him or not, I don't know if blocking the page is going to work or what.
He just can't get his home address and phone number.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to pay for the long-distance bills.
Surfers outside the U.S. have been unable to visit the official re-election site of President George W. Bush. The blocking of browsers sited outside the U.S. began in the early hours of Monday morning. This is back in, it's about 2 weeks ago. About a week and a half ago. Since then, people outside the U.S. trying to browse the site get a message saying that they're unauthorized to view it. The block does not appear to be due to an attack by vandals or malicious hackers, but by as a result of a policy decision by the Bush camp. The international exclusion zone around georgewbush.com was spotted by firm Netcraft, which keeps an eye on traffic patterns across many different sites. Netcraft said that since the early hours of the 25th of October, attempts to view the site through its monitoring stations in London, Amsterdam, and Sydney failed. By contrast, Netcraft's four monitoring stations in the U.S. managed to view the site with no problems. The site can still be seen using anonymous proxy services that are based in the United States, but some web users in Canada also reported that they can browse the site as well. So, I don't know. I never really understood what it's what's good in blocking people's, you know, like, you know, jamming out certain content on the net, you know, via countries. I don't really understand that.
Yeah, especially if it was that secret. Why is it even up?
Yeah, you know, it's just his, you know, whatever he's going to be doing, saying he's going to do, or whatever it is for the next couple years.
Oh, see, there you go. Now you get into, like, some scheduling stuff, and so maybe I'll, you know, some terrorist organizations can't get on it and do screwy stuff to it.
No, I honestly think it's not like it. I think it's like, they just want to block him out for some reason. I don't think it's, like, for security reasons.
Huh?
You know what I mean? Because it's another country blocking out their country from seeing that site.
Huh.
It's not like us blocking it.
Oh, it's everybody else.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. All right, well, head on over to bbsdocumentary.com, and basically Jason Scott's putting together a 3-DVD set.
Ooh.
With 7 hours of information on the old BBS scene.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's going to be available on DVD at the end of 2004. And you can check out the trailer over there and photo album and interview list and all sorts of stuff. So definitely check that out, because the BBS scene was a major portion of computer internet beginnings.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. I kind of was big into computers back in the BBS days.
You were?
Yeah.
What were you doing?
Putting around.
Well, yeah, that's what everyone's doing.
Yeah.
Did you ever use the Gopher protocol?
I don't remember.
That was before HTTP, going out and grabbing pages.
Yeah. Well, like, I remember having to dial in, and you know, then I could go and, you know, go to other, you know, other people's computers, and it was, or, you know, their bulletin boards.
I remember watching on, like, old school Netscape, like, watching each image, like, be really blocky, and then render again.
Yeah.
Again.
You get more and more excited.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, yeah. Oh, no, she's not hot. And then go to the next one. Just kidding. No, it wasn't. Okay, All right. Okay, here. Hacker strikes university computer system. Basically, I'm not sure if they should use hacker. Why don't they get all cool with their terms? Like, instead of calling terrorists, they call them insurgents.
Yeah.
Why can't they call technically minded individual strikes university computer system? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, or like information liberator.
Yeah, yeah. Information liberator. Hey. All right. Okay. A computer hacker assessed names and social security numbers of about 1.4 million Californians after breaking into a University of California, Berkeley computer system, and perhaps the worst attack of its kind ever suffered by the school officials. Yeah. I've actually seen somebody, it was a box that we ran, and they actually were getting into Berkeley computers, no doubt. Don't know what they were doing, but we're definitely into them. The investigation, this is a while ago, though. Investigation is continuing, but we have no idea if the personal information has been compromised, said Carlos Ramos, Assistant Secretary at the California Health and Human Services Agency. Wow. Does that even fit in a business card?
It front and back, maybe.
Yeah.
The rest of my title and information is on the back.
Yeah.
Flip it over, please.
Well, my email address is at californiahealthandhumanservicesagency.com/something.
Yeah, that's like half of the first, yeah, the front page of it.
That's, you know, you're going to charge extra for those cards. He said state agencies and the FBI were investigating, but the hacker had not been found. The names assessed by the hacker were being used by a UC Berkeley researcher who had collected data on elderly people and individuals who provided home care to seniors to study the impact on wages on in-home care. So this guy got the gold mine.
Yeah.
The data, which included home addresses, cell phone numbers, and dates of birth, was being used at the state's authorization, but without consent of the individuals whose information was being used in the study. Ramos said the state of the state is authorized to share with researchers the personal information of individuals who participate in state programs administered by the Social Services Department. Blah, 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 blah. Basically, it happened back on September 17th. Actually, no. At the end of August is when they had noticed that the system had broken into. They didn't notify the state until September 17th after the school had done its own investigation with the FBI. All right.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say about that. Things happen, I guess.
There's a red letter day, folks. Slip was wordless for a minute.
Yeah. I was like, I didn't really even know what to say. Like, happen? What am I? I don't know what the lesson to learn there is. I don't know.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see, because I'm sure you'll do it again.
Yeah.
I'll make fun of you for it. That'd
here,
be great.
Here is the scary article of the show.
Dun,
dun, dun. Scary article of the show. Okay.
American, the Monster Mash.
The Monster Mash. American passports will get RFID chips.
Oh, yes. And contain, what is that?
Biometric data.
Yeah, biometric data.
Yay! New U.S. passports will soon read remotely at borders around the world, thanks to embedded chips that will... You know, why do we get tracked better than the damn border?
Well, why do we get more accounted for and tracked better than Al-Qaeda?
I know. That sucks.
Yeah.
You know, are we the enemies? Are we the bigger enemies?
Yeah.
Are we the bigger problem?
Yeah, why do we delegate all this energy and money to, to tracking, boring little me?
Yeah, and you're pretty boring.
That's right.
I'm just kidding. A new U.S. passport will soon be read remotely at borders around the world thanks to embedded chips that will broadcast on command an individual's name, address, and digital photo to a computerized reader. The State Department hopes the addition of the chips would employ radio frequency identification or RFID tags technology, which will make passwords more secure and harder to forge.
Yeah. And it should, if it's done right, cut down the line waiting at the borders, right, airports, because they
don't. Somebody can read that card, not from a very long distance. So, the reason we're doing this is that it simply makes passports more secure.
Yeah,
and yet another layer beyond the security features we currently use to ensure the bearer is the person who issued the passport originally. But civil libertarians and some technologists say the chips are actually a boon to identity thieves, stalkers, and commercial data collectors, since anyone with the proper reader can download a person's biographical information and photo from several feet away.
Even that you just walk through a crowd, the airport, with that in your pocket.
Yeah. You know?
Like, beep, 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 beep.
He's over by the slushy machine. Get him now.
You can just hear cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
Yeah. You know, we did talk about an article back in the day about... that movie Total Recall, where you walk through the sensory and it shows like your bone structure and
the moving X-ray machine.
Yeah. Even if they want to store info on this chip, why have a chip that can be read remotely?
Yeah.
Just swipe the damn credit card or whatever, smart chip. Says Barry Steinhardt.
Or even better, do a barcode
on your head.
Yeah. Or in your hand, whichever, I don't care.
Who directs the civil, you got to make sure that hand is actually connected to the man's body that's holding the hand, Might be holding somebody else's hand. Why not require the passport be brought in contact with a reader so that the passport holder would know if it had been captured? Americans in the know will be wrapping their passports in aluminum foil.
Yeah.
Last week, four companies received contracts for the government to deliver prototype chips and readers immediately for evaluation. Diplomats and State Department employees will be issued the new passports as early as January, while other citizens applying for new passports will get the new version starting in the spring. So if you want, get one now. Countries around the world are also in the process of including the tags in their passports. in part due to U.S. government requirements that some nations add biometric information identification in order for the citizens to visit without a visa.
Well, actually, the U.S. was threatening already that once those chips are available, of not letting anybody come into the country without them.
Yeah, yeah, I heard
period.
That.
Just so, you know, like, yeah, you can get one that doesn't have it, but then you can't go anywhere once you go to the passport.
Yeah. The Electron Frontier Foundation attorney Lee Tain, I'm not sure, but I'm trying to say it correctly, argues that RFID chips and passports are a privacy horror and would be even if the data was encrypted.
Oh, yeah.
So, that is on the bunch of crap list for the show.
Yeah. That's a good big pile.
Yep. And, let's see here. This is a telescope being made in Arizona that,
ooh,
once it's done, will be 10 times crispier than the Hubble telescope.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. That should, like, be seeing the edge of the universe.
Yeah. I don't know where that edge is, but it's going to see it a lot clearer than the Hubble.
Well, it would be around 16 billion years ago.
16 billion.
Well, that's based on the redshift calculations.
It's amazing how much we can do from this little planet here. In the middle of this abyss.
And a little marble that floats around in space.
Yeah. I wonder if we see on the edge. Is it like a mirror to what's beyond? Like, you know, we look out there and some, like, big dinosaur, like, about to eat us.
Or you actually see, like,
yeah, I just started thinking of that screaming we were doing earlier.
Or you actually, like, see the fingernail clean, you know, fingernail cleaner utensil coming up.
Flippers?
Flick us out.
Oh, God.
We're all just dirt, a speck of dirt in somebody else's fingernail.
Yeah. An often grueling, troubled journey nears its end Friday with ceremonies dedicated that will be the world's most powerful optical telescope, so in 20 years after its inception.
Wow.
Even now, the University of Arizona is $120 million large binocular telescope isn't complete, but astronomers with Stewart Observatory, which oversees the project, hope to begin using the instrument between February and April, looking for heavenly breakthroughs. One of its two 8.4-meter mirrors, each nearly 28 feet in diameter.
Wow. 28 feet in diameter.
Yes. Is in place, with its final aluminum coating to be applied over the next 2 months. Initial test images have been taken already. Its twin is still being polished, and installation is unlikely before the middle of next year, with final operation of both mirrors in tandem anticipate either late next year or early in 2006. But the fact that the LBT perched on top of a 10,700-foot Mount Graham near the New Mexico line is about to operate at all means it has survived. It's about to operate. At all means, it has survived a litany of changes from environmentalists, American Indians, and even wildfire.
Wow.
The dedication means that we have gotten to the point where the telescope has come together and it's beginning to work, said Peter Strugerman, director of Stewart. You know, these articles have to throw all these people's names in, you know. Hey, come Pete, can you put my name in there?
Yeah.
A partnership of several scientific institutions that built the telescope. I built the telescope, buddy.
Yeah, you got to give credit where credit's due.
Yeah.
Gotta give props. But imagine that, if, like, the Earth wasn't round, like, you could probably, like, you know, let's say it was flat, flat from here to New York, that you could probably look into somebody's window in New York City from that mountain.
Oh, yeah, it was flat.
Yeah. So, but, like, that's that kind of power of telescope.
It's amazing that it seems like the photons would be so darn dense. Like, you know, like the level of density is insane.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. It's just really weird to me. Okay. The LPT, largest of three telescopes in the Mount Graham International Observatory Complex, will be used to explore never-seen things like planets the size of Jupiter and solar systems 20 to 30 light-years away.
Wow.
The LPT's glass mirrors were especially cast at the university through a unique process, creating a relatively lightweight, extremely strong honeycombed understructure. They will have an edge-to-edge light-gathering surface of 76 feet, about 10 times the mirror diameter of the Hubble Space Telescope.
Wow.
The ending result will images will be 10 times as sharp as the Hubble's, enhanced by a technology called adaptive optics to adjust and correct the Earth's atmospheric turbulence.
Yeah, that's what I was like, you know, that's a little sketchy. It can't really be 10 times. Because there is that the heat distortion in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Which is kind of neat because it's kind of like that, you know, light is still a part of matter and it can be warped and that gravity just has an effect on it. So relativity isn't that, you know, like mind-blowing of a thing because stuff like that happens.
Yes. All right, well, that was quite a bit of information. Another jam-packed show.
That it was.
Yes. And I will be putting it up here shortly.
And somebody needs to pull the plug in my brain because I think I'm full.
All right. Okay. Well, we'll be putting the October 17th show up at a later date. And we'll also be seeing people in 2 weeks with our next show. But stay tuned. And see you in 2 weeks. This is Slip Mode signing out.
And VR saying nothing.
At all. Okay. We'll see you then.
But I guess I'd say, if it is just a... It seems like an awful waste of space. guess I'd say it is just us. Seems like an awful waste of space.
You're tuned into Perfecto Radio, Chicago, Detroit, Seattle.